Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Leadership Enigma. Now, the globally ranked award-winning podcast with over 250 videos on our YouTube channel. So please do remember to like and subscribe on that channel. We are going from strength to strength. And in the new year, we have an incredible set of guests. And I'm looking forward to this particular episode because this is going to be part and parcel of our ongoing CEO series. So here are some questions for all of our watchers and listeners. Is why would you take on something that's never been done before, especially when you don't even know if it will work? And perhaps the risks are so high, we're talking about the risk to human life. So why? Why would somebody take on that particular challenge? Well, that's why we're going to be talking to the wonderful Dan Hart here, who decided to do just that and decided to become the CEO of Virgin Orbit. Come back to me just after this break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to the Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper, into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Dan, it's a warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
Great. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, and I'm very, very appreciative for you. I know it is early on the West Coast that you're joining us today, so it's a huge thank you. It really is. Listen, I just did a very, very brief introduction as to why on earth would anyone take on that particular role as CEO of Virgin Orbit. We'll come on to that. But let me just start from the beginning. Let me go way, 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 way back and just give some people a little bit of a potted history of your CV before we get on to that particular role that you took on.
Well, let's see. Without going into a lot of detail, I mean, I grew up in New York. I was not part of a engineering family. I was actually, my dad was an oil painter.
Yep.
And I found my way to Kennedy Space Center in the early 80s. Worked on Space Lab 1, which was the first big collaboration between ESA and NASA. Really exciting time. I mean, the early shuttle days, new things happening, getting a chance to do things or be part of things that had never happened before. And then I came up through engineering, launch vehicles, satellites, missile defense systems, and ended up in a kind of a high-level leadership position running the satellite programs at the Boeing company. And then I got a call to come over to Virgin Orbit. Would I be interested in taking on this exciting project?
There are so many questions I already have. So let me start with firing those off at you. Did you always know you would end up in this particular arena, or was it by chance, by network? How did it come about?
I knew what I wanted to do.
Right.
And you know, when I think about why, it's probably a combination of science and science fiction. When I was a kid, my parents made me stay up late one night in 1969
right.
to watch a grainy black and white TV set and Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon. And something in my head said, this is important and it ought to be pursued. And I want to be a part of that. When I was in college and I was thinking about how am I going to get a job, I picked up the phone. I called up Houston, Texas Information. I asked for the phone number for NASA.
As you do.
The operator said, well, there's a lot of phone numbers for NASA, and started to read through the directory. Administration, aerodynamics, no, astronaut corps. Yeah, give me that. I'll take the astronaut corps. And I cold called the astronaut corps. And to my, to my luck, I guess, they actually, instead of hanging up on me, referred me. And I eventually found my way to where a few months later, I was heading down to Kennedy Space Center. And I was beside myself. I mean, in joy. I could not believe, I was actually going to use the restroom that, John Glenn might have used, 30 years earlier. Anyway, let's not go down that trail.
Well, I love the fact that you cold called NASA, and then before you knew it, you were on your way.
Yeah, it was pure luck, honestly. I mean, I had no connections, and I had frankly no knowledge. It was all acquired later.
Right. And you said also you'd had a you'd I think is it correct? You'd had 3 decades at Boeing.
That's correct. And in a lot of different kinds of programs.
Right.
I started off in the space shuttle program. As I mentioned, the Challenger accident happened in 86,
I remember.
and things were in a little bit of chaos. And I was called over to Cape Canaveral to help launch this old Delta rocket, which grew up or got refurbished, and I was part of that. And it became the workhorse for NASA for quite a while. And then we developed a new set of Delta rockets. So, I mean, it was sort of one interesting new adventure after another.
I remember the Challenger incident in 86, I think you said, Dan. And
January.
what impact did that have on the industry? Did it create a complete stop to things, or was there a period of reflection of, well, I don't know,
Well,
you tell me.
it was all of that. And
Yeah.
I would say it had an effect on the industry. It had a stronger effect, I think, on the individuals in the industry.
Right.
In the industry, it stopped the shuttle program for a couple of years,
Right.
and then put it on a di very different kind of operating mode and reset the objectives. For the individuals, I mean, I was standing outside in the cold January morning, outside my office, watching a space shuttle launch with my workmates and
Yeah.
friends. And, we saw it unfold, and we were, holding hope to see a space shuttle fly out of that cloud.
Right.
And then we heard the announcement that the vehicle has exploded. And, it just completely gripped us and changed the way we thought.
What impact did it have then on you and the industry in relation to doing things again, learning from that incident, or almost a determination to get it right or still learn from what was, a life-changing event for many.
I would say, first of all, we all knew that this was a dangerous enterprise, and that there were risks. So, it didn't take us completely by surprise that there could be an accident. When my office was upstairs, out of the on the alleyway where the astronauts get into their truck. So I saw them. I would run into them in the building, and I saw that they were people to me.
Yes.
They weren't just, images on a screen. And so, you see people one day, and the next day they've perished. That emotionally hits you, and the importance of safety, it becomes more and more real. And then, as we studied what had happened, you get into understanding the psychology of the organization and how it operated and didn't operate. The communication gaps between the engineer who had a concern about the O-rings on a cold morning and the manager's manager who was communicating with somebody in NASA
Yeah.
who gave a bit of a different, maybe didn't tell the wrong story, or maybe did, but that definitely told a different story. And how that then bent into, okay, we can go. And I'd say that's a lesson all of us took, for the rest of our lives, the rest of our careers.
Do you think there was a piece of organization or even industry learning that flowed from that
Oh,
particular
yes.
event?
I'd also say, though, it's something that is learned periodically, unfortunately,
Right.
because organizations do this. And in my coming to Virgin, I was very mindful of this, that if you put yourself in a separate room away and you don't interact and you don't get on the floor and you don't talk to people, you could come up with a very different idea of what's going on than what really is going on.
So I want to kind of ask you questions as to, you had, excuse my voice, you had 3 decades successfully at Boeing. And then you get the call, I think it's 2017, to say, will you come and take the role?
2016.
2016, forgive me. Take the role on of Virgin Orbit. Was that a call from Richard himself, or was it someone within the organization? Or who was it who tried to twist your arm at this point to say, would you like a new challenge, Dan?
Well, the initial call I got was from a recruiter, and it's somebody who I had talked to periodically through the years, who usually had an opportunity that, I had to move to the end of the earth to go to, and I would say, no, I don't think I really want to move out of Southern California to do that. She was ready for me, and she said, "This is 4 miles away from your house. Why don't you have the conversation?" And so I did, and she explained a bit of it. I had been following, certainly I'd been following the new space activities and SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and Virgin Orbit and some of the others. So I was very interested. I was curious. And so the package of doing something, another big project, something that had never been done, and getting to work it in a different culture with Richard Branson and his Virgin group was very appealing to me. And so I went for the conversations, and one thing led to another.
There's never any harm in having a conversation, is there? Just
Exactly.
help some of us who are the uninitiated. What's the difference between, excuse me again, what's the difference between Virgin Galactic and Virgin Orbit?
Well, Virgin Galactic, first of all, when I was talking to them initially, Virgin Orbit didn't exist and it was all under Virgin Galactic. But basically, the difference is Virgin Galactic is a company that's focused on space tourism. And so, astronauts or potential astronauts get into a spaceship that's carried up by a mothership, and then it takes them into a suborbital trajectory that gets them into space, and they can see the world and so forth. Virgin Orbit was set up to launch satellites. So it's not the rocket does not have a crew in it. Of course, the airplane does. But it was set up to go up for a 747 to carry a large rocket under its wing and then drop the rocket, and the rocket would fly into space. And the idea was use the energy of the 747 and the efficiency of the 747, gain altitude and velocity, drop the rocket, and now the rocket has to do less work.
And so when you were first contacted with this, as you say, Virgin Orbit was something that didn't exist. It was about to do something, it was trying to do something brand new, wasn't it, that had never been done before. What just help everyone understand what that was.
Well, there has never been a liquid rocket launched off of the wing of an airplane to orbit. There were in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, there was the speed of sound was conquered with the X1 that had a liquid in it, the X15 later on, but none of those were orbital. This was a big rocket. And I believe it's the largest vehicle that's ever left the wing of an airplane. So, and a liquid rocket is a complicated animal. Fueling it horizontally is very different than normal. I mean, normally it's standing in the launch pad. Everybody's 3 miles away in a safe control room. And, the rocket does what the rocket's going to do. This was very different. A crew needed to go out to disconnect it from the ground. And people don't usually go near a fueled and pressurized rocket. And then a crew needed to go into the airplane and fly it out to the launch point and initiate it.
So this is, I come back to my original introduction. What was the compelling reason for you to take the role when the remit was to do something that had never been done before? It may never work, and there was a high risk and a high risk to human life. And you said, absolutely, count me in. What was it?
I mean, that's the legacy of this whole business. That's what we do. I mean, that's why I got into it, and the people who I work with got into this, is to stretch the envelope. You know, I didn't get into the Postal Service. I didn't get into textile manufacturing. I got into a business where you do development, you're not always sure it's going to go, and the risks are usually high and the rewards are usually high, and you can see, you know, what's the upside? You see the world change around you, sometimes directly due to the work that your team does. I mean, when I go outside and I, you know, see somebody using their navigation system, I know that they're talking to GPS satellites that my team at Boeing made.
Right.
And that's a feeling that, you know, I don't know, I can't really describe it, but it frankly is very satisfying. And so it's high risk, and every once in a while you see the world change around you because of something that you've done. And that's the objective, or the the incentive.
I'm intrigued by something, and tell me if you can help with this, because a lot of people will associate the current inertia on space and space tourism, they'll associate that with high net worth individuals and iconic billionaires, whether that's Sir Richard Branson, whether that's Elon, whether that's Jeff Bezos. What is it that's compelling them to get involved in this? It can't just be the resources. I'm assuming that's a big part of it. But what do you think is compelling these people to start to look at this as something they need to focus their time, effort, and resource to?
Well, I think it's the same thing. I think it's the potential. The you know, space is limitless. And there's probably a number of different aspects. I mean, look, a number of people are getting involved for the experiential aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can see the world, I can fly higher. I mean, you know, Mount Everest in space, basically.
Yeah.
So you see that happening. Additionally, you see closer to business, you see huge enterprises. I mean, communication is changing the world. The way we communicate through satellites, the way we can see what's going on around the world. I mean, those sort of world-changing technologies are very attractive to the business side of that community. You know, and then personally, I gravitate a little further over to the science aspect.
Okay.
Because there's so much happening there.
What are some of the biggest developments that are at the forefront of your thinking over the last few decades for you? What really stands out to you?
Well, I mean, certainly launch reusability has been enormous.
Right.
And you were seeing that play out. But the fact that you and I, when we watch the evening news, are almost every day looking at a satellite picture of somewhere.
Mm.
And our expectation today is that we'll see one, is pretty astounding. It's been insidious because it's crept in. But you know, if our satisfaction, our level of satisfaction with not knowing what's going on somewhere is really low. Okay. I mean, why we sit there and we think, well, why is there not a video? I mean, you know, where, give me the information, give it instantly. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, we would have been satisfied that somebody in a dark room in some government might have seen something to tell us what's going on. So we're seeing awareness that we've never seen before, and it's going to pick up even more. I mean, we're seeing AI now connecting with space imagery and, you know, understanding if a bridge has moved or, you know, if a natural disaster is imminent. We're seeing use cases that we've never seen, and it's just going to pick up from here. So incredibly exciting there. And then on the science side,
yep.
I mean, there are two missions going to Jupiter right now to study the moons and look for life potentially there. We have, helicopters flying, little drone copter flying on Mars until recently. We have a gravitational observatory in a couple of years that's going to go active. A whole new way of looking at the universe. We are mapping the dark matter using the Webb telescope right now to where we're going to have a map of all the dark. I mean, the things that are happening right now in space science and commercially, it's like a renaissance.
What do you think is the most exciting thing that may happen in our lifetime, Dan?
Well, it depends upon who you are. I would say our understanding of the universe has already changed enormously to where we've realized that we understand 5 or 10% of it. I mean, we've been looking at 5 or 10% of the matter in the universe. I'd say that's pretty dramatic. And we're going to understand so much more about fundamentally what we have. And then on the other side of the spectrum, again, we're going to get back to the moon, but we are going to have this network that makes use of space to help life here on Earth. And I think that's the most exciting. A lot of folks are talking about living on Mars or this or that. That's not where it's at.
Right.
Where it's at is our understanding of this place and this neighborhood that we live in, and having incredible tools so that we can behave ourselves, hopefully, and take care of it.
That would be nice as well, as we go slightly mad, don't we, on this planet. So if there are some lessons from out there, let's bring them in. Let me go back as well, because if you've moved from Boeing to Virgin Orbit, you're going from a big traditional monolithic organization to a very small startup. What was that like for you to be at the helm of this highly entrepreneurial, agile, small, probably resource-strung slightly organization?
Well, it was very liberating.
Tell me more.
I mean, needless to say, I mean, and let me explain, in the space sector at Boeing, it was more neighborhoods than, it wasn't quite as monolithic as, we're going to build 500 airplanes this year. This satellite project, this launch project. So it's a little more neighborhood-like in that sector of Boeing. So I was used to moving around to different projects and different kinds of customers and so forth. But, Boeing has a brand, Boeing has layers of process, and coming over to Virgin where we could reinvent that, and we weren't just encouraged to, we were expected to, was amazing. The people that I worked with there, the people who had gathered for this never been done before thing, for this environment, were also, highly skilled, highly energetic and excited. And yeah, they were colliding all over the place with each other, because that's what happens when smart, excited people get together in the room. There's eight opinions for the four people in the room. But a lot of creativity. And man, that's where the magic happens. When great technical talent meets creativity, any problem can be solved.
Let me ask, because obviously Virgin Orbit is under the Virgin brand, and Sir Richard Branson is someone very, very well known, not only on the global stage, but very much within this country, within the UK. What was it like for you as a senior and experienced leader to now stand shoulder to shoulder with quite a visionary? What was it like, though, from a day-to-day basis, to work with an individual like that in trying to achieve something that is legacy stuff?
Well, I mean, it was, working with Richard was amazing. It was really interesting also. And I think, look, I think it's very, this kind of situation is very personality dependent on, I've heard horror stories, but I had a great experience. And I think it's all a function of the awareness of the leader you're working with. And Richard is a very aware person. He's aware of And he's a very creative person. I mean, and he's a very inquisitive person. So he would ask questions. He certainly would want to know what was going on, but would offer ideas and questions. And it would make you have open up your own creative thoughts. Well, what about this? Is this possible? Could we do this? Are there other solutions? So very really interesting. And a lot of fun. But again, I really give Richard a tremendous amount of credit because it's a matter of how what his style is in working with leaders, to sort of bring them out versus shut them down.
Now, I obviously have the wonderful opportunity to speak to so many CEOs like yourself as part of this particular show. And so I'd like to ask a question. When you go into a new challenge such as this Virgin Orbit, when you have got iconic figures, but you've also got a new team, you've got science and technology, how do you quickly find your space, no pun intended, within that organization? How do you suddenly find where your value will really be? As the leader of that organization.
Well, I think you really, I mean, it's you need to evaluate the project and the team and where their strengths are, but you also need to think about in this kind of project, where must I be?
Right.
And to me, the answers were fairly clear. On the one hand, I needed to be the positive drive that we can get this done because it was going to be hard. It
Right.
was going to be exhausting. And I knew that. So I needed certainly to be continually pushing the what we were going to achieve. At the same time, back to the whole Challenger discussion, I was very much aware that I needed to be not only talking to customers and investors, but out down on the floor
Right.
with the engineers and the technicians in a way that they would be comfortable talking to me. That if there was something that was not right, they could come up to me and say, "Hey, Dan, do you have a minute?" And so I wanted to be available. I was, and so I mean, I think there are these themes. Depending upon the kind of job that you have and the kind of objective, some of them are kind of common. I mean, you want an open environment, but where you place yourself as the CEO matters. It applies emphasis. So I mean, certainly, we had our rituals of the teams coming together periodically and sharing, okay, where are we and what's the schedule and what's the business plan and all that kind of stuff. But there were other days where we were doing a critical, maybe safety critical operation, and I wanted to support the team by standing shoulder to shoulder with them.
Let me ask you a little bit about a specific event because you and I spoke previously about this. Now, let me give you a summary and then you can tell me where I've got things wrong. And we spoke, didn't we, about you worked with the UK government in relation to a national event. I think there was going to be a first launch from Western Europe, first launch from the UK. So you were having to liaise with Boris Johnson, with space agencies, ministers, the CAA, the RAF, the NATO. So how does somebody manage a series of stakeholders like that in order to align them on the direction of travel that you, again, no pun intended, on the direction of travel that you have as a business? Because I remember you used a phrase to me the other day where you said we were punching above our weight. And so I kind of want to get your perspective on all of this, that ability to punch above your weight, to achieve things that ordinarily you couldn't do, but also that stakeholder alignment piece, Dan. How on earth do you manage that?
It was an amazing set of experiences. And first of all, I'd say we didn't do it alone. We had allies within in the government fabric to help us do that. And we certainly, and we had, of course, every once in a while we had a little help from Richard and some of his from our chairman and other people who understood the British system.
Yes.
But in the end of the day, I mean, we were a small company for aerospace standards. We were And we were going to do a national event. The attractiveness of space is sort of what brought it to the Boris Johnson level.
Right.
We were invited to the G7 summit in 2021,
Wow.
which blew my mind to begin with. I had to say, you want us to do what? But then, we were a team. We were a very can-do team.
Right.
And immediately my head of communications was figuring out how to get a rocket over to the UK, and we were going to be there on the apron where the world leaders were coming in and all this. But it started with some fairly high level attention, meeting the Prime Minister, meeting the Secretary of State for Transportation and for Bays, and so we knew that we had some strong support. We knew that there would be a bureaucracy associated with it. And so,
For sure.
this was a first launch ever from the UK, to orbit. And so, the CAA, who I the, and the individuals I respect tremendously, but they have a process that they looked at this, it was like a deer in the
There's
headlights.
probably
You
no
want us to
playbook
do
for this,
what?
Dan.
There was no, there was this is this exactly. So, they were saying from the start, this is going to take whatever, a year and a half, and we had maybe 8 months to do it.
Right.
And we worked with them, and I'd say my team was very open and tried to push information, which is what you do with regulatory communities. But it was a constant discussion at the various levels. I got to know some of the senior executives in the various departments of government. Periodically, I could reach out to a minister, Minister of Science, and the Secretary of State when I absolutely needed to try to share, look, here's the situation. I mean, we're going to have to go home if we can't. If we can't solve certain problems.
Yeah.
We went to the UK, before we got a license, betting on the come. It was very much an adventure in just driving forward with a launch team, a rocket ship, and an airplane, and working as openly and as we could with the professionals at the CAA. And then we had all these other organizations getting interested, which was actually difficult. And then we had to negotiate airspace with Portugal and Spain and France and Ireland. And again, we were just sort of suited up, got into the room, and it was Virgin Orbit negotiating with Spain.
So how do you keep pushing through that level of complexity, stakeholder engagement, probably nervousness in relation to should we even be doing this and what are the consequences of it not working out? How do you keep pushing through in order to get the outcome you want when you're in that level of complexity?
I mean, it goes back to the beginning of this conversation. This was another, this has never been done before. And we have the gift, the opportunity to break through that barrier. And that's what gets you out of bed. And the team was excited about it. The people in Cornwall, the Cornwall Council, the Spaceport Cornwall, the UKSA, they were excited about it, and it was frankly very contagious. And so we knew we were doing something important, and that's what drove us. It was a bizarre time. I mean, because any day, any on any given day, I'd look at the calendar and okay, in the morning we're going to talk about a LOX valve issue, and then in the afternoon, we've got a meeting with the Royal Navy to figure out how to clear an area, in Irish airspace or something. Really interesting discussion.
Regular problems.
Exactly.
Was it a benefit or a hindrance that it had never been done before? How did you find that aspect? Did it help you, or was it a real plug?
I mean, psychologically, it helped us.
Yep.
I mean, it was a motivator. Practically, it was brutal.
You can imagine.
We were making it up. And I mean, we had one day where I was back in the States at the time. I got a call that the local police had come by and they were saying they might have to arrest everybody because we were manufacturing ordnance. And I said, what? They said, well, we have this explosive charge on the front end of the rocket. It's a little strip, and you had to bolt the fairing together, the two halves. And they said bolting that together in the details of the law amounted to manufacturing ordnance, something we didn't make any sense to me. But, you know, this is probably a law that was
welcome to the UK,
written in the 15th century. And you know, they didn't want to arrest our team, but they were, you know, and so I've got people 6,000 miles away in the middle of, you know, an airport kind of in the middle of nowhere about to be arrested for, you know, and then we had to quickly call up various folks, and they allowed us a little bit of time to apply for an ordnance manufacturing license, which we did, and they granted it. But there were things like that that were just, you know, very difficult. They slowed us down, but we were able to, with frankly, with a lot of cooperation, a lot of support from the people involved on the other side, we were able to navigate things like that.
How many successful launches did Virgin Orbit have?
We had four in a row, which, I mean, we had one flight test here at the beginning.
Yep.
And then amazingly, the next flight was perfect. And amazingly, the next one was. And so we had four of those in a row, which frankly is about as good as it ever gets, as anybody's ever done in this business, to get that kind of a record right out of the gate. That second launch, NASA, I had gone to NASA and saying, look, you're booked for this flight. We just had a failure on the first flight. I'll do another test flight. Don't worry. And to their credit, they said, no, we'll fly with you. And so our second flight right after a failure was with 12 NASA satellites.
Right.
I did a big gulp when they said that, and the team did. And to their credit, they learned everything they needed to from the first flight, and it was a beautiful day.
So the first one had failed.
Right.
But the second one, they were going to put 12. I want to just focus on that, because a lot of people, a lot of organizations, let's be honest, they're risk averse and they don't like the word failure and they hate to be seen to fail. But I'm assuming in this industry, you have to fail, Dan. You must fail. If you're doing things for the first time, you're going to fail. How do you deal with the fact that you know you're going to fail, potentially at a spectacular level, but you're going to learn from it and you're going to move on, and that's what success comes from. How do you deal with that from a mindset perspective?
Well, I mean, you know, like a lot of things, there's this intellectual side and there's an emotional side.
Right.
You know, when the first flight failed, you know, the emotional side does hit. You know, the phone rang right afterwards, and it was Richard, and he said, when's the next rocket going to be ready? Was the, you know, I mean, and you snap into the intellectual side snaps immediately into curiosity on, well, what happened?
Right.
And let's dig. And you have all this data, and everybody's immediately all over it. And frankly, they're enjoying in a weird way the heck out of learning, you know, where did things go wrong and how to fix them. And engineers love to fix things. So, you know, you go right into that. Personally, on this day, you know, I left the control room feeling, you know, not great. And there was a get together of the team, the launch team and the engineers and some of the families, across the way up at Mojave where we were doing this testing, and or the launch. And I went there, and as soon as I opened the door, there were cheers, and everyone was so excited about what we had done, the steps that we had taken forward. And it made me think, and it was an interesting lesson for me, in that the team, You spend all this time pulling the team forward.
Yeah.
There are times when the team pushes you forward. And that was sort of this very beautiful moment of, they're right. I mean, this is the first time in history anybody has ever prepared a horizontal rocket. We did that. We did the whole countdown successfully. We did it safely. And yeah, the rocket flew for a few seconds and had a problem, but look at the steps we took forward.
Right.
And, that's where the day ended.
That's powerful, isn't it? Because that's enjoying and understanding and learning from the journey, not just the destination. So there was a failure in the final elements of the rocket launch, but actually all of the steps were being celebrated. That's really what you're describing to me. And there was energy.
Exactly.
And what was the impact then of Richard Branson ringing you up after a failure and saying, when's the next rocket ready? What's the impact on you when somebody like that just says, let's go again?
I mean, it was, it was like an instant turn.
Right.
Immediately my head went into, okay, tomorrow.
Wow.
From today. And I was, and the fact is, I was able to share that with the rest of the team instantly also. So that news of that call spread through the team instantly. Okay, guys, Richard wants to know when the next rocket's going to be ready. So wash your hands, slap your jeans, whatever you need to do to get out of today's moment, and let's get into tomorrow's.
Incredible. We talk about the shadow of the leader, and I think that's a great story there. Let's take this to the end of Virgin Orbit, because remind me, what year Virgin Orbit came to an end? It filed for bankruptcy. I think that's right, isn't it? And you remind me of the date, because it was
2023.
So again, so help me from there, because I know you've done many media interviews, you've done many articles. I've looked at some of those, and when something comes to a natural conclusion such as that, what were your reflections as a CEO? Because I know you said, look, there's been some mistakes, and you were the head of the organization. What reflections do you take of what an incredible journey you've been on, but it has come to a conclusion?
Well, I mean, you really take hold of the accomplishments and the group of people, were able to complete. I mean, we changed space technology,
right,
in what we did, and most importantly, and we touched on this a bit, but we did it safely, and we were taking risks and managing them. And to me, those were the biggest accomplishments of the team. We verified and proved something, and we did something nobody else had done at a pace and at a record that very few have ever been able to do.
Right.
In terms of the company, we went public, unfortunately, right at the time when interest rates had climbed and were climbing higher.
Mm-hmm.
Inflation was at 7% in the U.S. and the investment community froze. I mean, there were no deals done, and we didn't have enough money. And it was a technology, even though the U.K., Japan, Korea, Brazil, Italy, and many other countries were wanting to make use of the system, they weren't moving forward. They
Right.
They were slow. Even the UK, I mean, they could have, they could have booked another launch right away, and it would have helped us. But they were sort of paralyzed because we actually failed on that launch from Cornwall,
right?
Deep into the flight. So, I mean, look, you think about it, there are aspects of timing, like the markets, like the technology and the slowness of government. You think about the team, which are right now all over the place pushing other space companies forward. And I think that's the value of the experience. I mean, we made our moment. We did stretch the envelope to another place in space launch.
Yep.
And we created a community that's helping other communities.
What's your advice then for any leader at any level who just has to, he or she just have to dust yourself down sometimes, get back up and think, Right. Next. What's kind of your advice for anyone who we're all going to go through it continually, but sometimes not ready for it?
Well, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's compartmentalization.
Right.
We touched on it a bit ago. You know, intellectually, there is a tomorrow. And, and that's what's going to pull you forward. Use your creativity and your knowledge and your awareness and look at tomorrow, even when the lights go out behind you.
I know. Look at that, right? All of our screens have gone dark. So there.
Wow.
They're back again. There we go. We're testing it.
And then, you know, deal with the emotional. I mean, it's real. I went to the beach a lot, and looked at the waves. You know, do whatever you like to do. I was playing drums in an 80s cover band, beating the heck out of those drums. Do what you want to do, what you need to do to process. And there is a lot of processing to do. But tomorrow, I mean, look at, you know, back to the beginning of this discussion, look at what's going on in space. And, it's an incredible experience to be connected to them. And there's so much potential. And there's so many people coming along and, a lot of fun.
So a lot of leaders who are hopefully watching and listening to this, what should they be thinking about or even aware of in relation to the technology that's involved in space travel and space exploration and the world that you've lived in? How is that relevant to leaders on a day-to-day basis, do you think?
Well, I think today leaders across businesses need to be thinking about how could space capabilities help them.
Okay.
I think there's a huge opportunity here for business leaders to think about, well, what if, logistics, what if I could keep track of the temperature of that thing all through its shipment and I had it on my phone? What if I knew where everything was? There's, from a technology point of view, we're in a revolution and get your team's thinking and juices refreshed and be thinking about how technology is going to change your world, because it is. And if it doesn't change yours, it's going to change your competitors. In terms of an adventure like Virgin Orbit, suit up, get in, drive forward, and you can make incredible things happen.
Dan, we've talked about NASA, we've talked about Boeing, we've talked about Virgin Orbit, and you've talked about tomorrow. So what is the future hold for you, Dan?
Well, you know what, I've had the opportunity in the last year, besides working slightly less than 100 hours a week,
right,
to be a part of a lot of different technologies that are coming about. So, and I think I'll continue to do that. So, I'm advising in quantum technology right now, which is an incredibly exciting area. It's not space, but it's not unrelated to space and in the applications. I was appointed to the Space Studies Board, so I'm getting more involved in space science. And some of these, interesting future missions going on. And I'm helping, a number of companies with discussions not that different from this, with where they are, with satellites, launch vehicles, nuclear power, a lot of different things. So I think I will be taking my experiences and, frankly, integrating it with lots of different kinds of technology initiatives going on. I'm doing some writing as well. I'm a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and so I have a few opinions about global space and how countries should collaborate and what technologies should be used for. I'm doing a project on wildfire intelligence, of how we can use space and drones and computational technology, right, to better understand and predict wildfires and better address them. So there's a lot of different, I'd say, hobbies I have right now, and I can plan on continuing to do that
I think we described
for the foreseeable future.
We described that as a mixed portfolio, I think, Dan. I know it's still early in the morning for you, but my final question is this. With all of this rich experience and exposure to all kinds of things, and, you know, this isn't a conversation I've had in 220 interviews so far in relation to space, so I'm truly humbled by it and excited by it. What's the best piece of leadership advice that you've ever given or received?
Boy, the best piece of leadership. I would say it's this. There's no problem that can't be solved with five smart people around a whiteboard.
I love that. And in fact, strangely, that was something that was said to me in a slightly different way by another CEO only about 4 weeks ago of a global pharmaceutical company. So I'm obviously going to have to dig into this one a little bit more in relation to that actual aspect of five smart people around a whiteboard. Listen, Dan, thank you so much. I do appreciate all your hard effort. I know we had some technical issues at the start, but thank you very much for helping us to resolve those. And I just want to say thank you for taking the time early morning, West Coast, even though you are in a beautiful part of the world, to join us on the Leadership Enigma. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed. Take care. Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.